broadcasting from the University of Indianapolis. This is 88.7 The Diamond, WICR-FM and HD1 Indianapolis.
The opinions expressed on the following program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WICR management or ownership.
It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
And good afternoon to you. I am Jill Dittmeyer, the curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we use art to teach science. Welcome to
She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And today we are going to be talking about the art and engineering of beer.
I hear
the cheers going out there in our listening audience. And you cheering out there, we want to hear from you today. If you have some questions for our guests, we welcome them. Or if you just want to make your comments on the art and engineering of beer, the number to call today is 317-788-3314. And we do have two guests in studio today. Mark, introduce them.
Right. I'm excited to introduce Peter Batui, who's engineer and owner of Upland Brewery. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Thanks you very much, yeah.
And Lee Daniels, who's a local microbrewer, but also an engineer.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
And he's wearing his Foam Blowers of Indiana shirt, too.
Yes.
It's very cool. So one of the exciting things, Jill, that we thought about, you and I, with this particular show, was that both of these individuals are engineers.
Yeah.
And they've moved into the whole art of making beer. And so,
which is science.
Which is
too.
Science and art.
And art.
And it's everything. So it's pretty exciting. So, Peter, how did you move from being an engineer to being a brewer?
Yeah, it's a kind of a long story, but, like a lot of brewers that are in professional brewing now started out homebrewing. So, I've always worked, straight out of college, always worked in food and beverage production. So I started out working at Quaker Oats, made some fun products there, Rice-A-Roni, made some pasta on a very large scale. So that's kind of fun. Then I moved over to Gatorade here in Indianapolis. And so I learned a lot about packaging and bottling and all that. And it was around that time when I started homebrewing at home. And in college, I was really into wine and wine tasting and sensory, and so craft beer kind of really caught my attention because it utilized all those same skills. And so an opportunity came along with Upland, and they needed somebody that could understand production and bring in a larger scale, and the company's growing quite a bit, put in a new brewery, and so that's when I joined the companies, and we put in our expanded brewery from our original brew pub to our actual production facility. So that's when I came in, and it was just a lucky opportunity that I had, and taking what I knew from homebrewing and very similar process on a large scale, but utilizing some of the engineering skill sets and understanding how to manipulate the beer on a little bit larger scale served me really well, and was a great easy transition for me. It's something I was very excited and passionate about too. So that's a quick background of my story.
That's a good story. And Lee, I know from your background, it's electrical engineering, but computer engineering specifically. And you were actually at one point doing computer hardware, designing computers, and then software. How did you transition to beer?
Well, I got into computers early on in high school. I met my first computer in 1971, I think it was, and went that way in school, did computer design and software beyond that. Beer was sort of just an accident. I'd always enjoyed some of the craft beers. I never got into the big domestic beers. But it was back only in about 7 years ago in 2012 that my wife and my daughter were trying to think, Lee's, he's a workaholic. What can we get him as a hobby? So a $40 homebrew kit, 1 gallon, spend 5 hours on the stove brewing 1 gallon of beer. You get about 9 bottles out of that, and I had a good time. And I did about 20 more of those that first year of 1 gallon kits, and then expanded up to 5 gallons, which is where most of the homebrewers are in the 5-10 gallon range for homebrewing. But instead of being a workaholic, I guess I became a we'll say beeraholic.
Beeraholic.
Not
So how did your engineering skills transfer to your beer making, or have they really?
Well, beer is all about science. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's every aspect of making beer is requires science. It requires the engineering of how your system is going to be put together and function. So it's a natural. If I look at my homebrew club, the Foam Blowers of Indiana, more than half the guys and women who are in that club have engineering backgrounds. Yeah. They work out there as engineers. It may be civil engineering, it may be environmental engineering, but it's the majority of them are in engineering or science in general, because it just lends itself. The details of brewing a batch of beer are the same sort of details that are required in a good engineering.
And that's really interesting, too. As you mentioned, there are a lot of retired scientists or scientists out there that have developed some of the new craft breweries around the state and everything, as opposed to, and you mentioned, Peter, your interest in wine. Mm. Wine, it encounters science, too, but it's really more of a farming. There's a lot of farming in wine. Beer, you can get that pretty quick.
Yeah, the ingredients for beer are pretty readily available, and that's, you know, 7,000 plus breweries now, and
that's
and you can open up a brewery just about anywhere because, you know, those ingredients, malt, hops, yeast, and water, now are just easily available for home brewers and professional brewers kind of all over the country, and so absolutely, it's a completely different process. And I like to say, brewing, there's such a broader spectrum of flavors to work with too, you know. We're not just trying to capture that flavor of that one grape. We've got, you know, dozens and dozens of types of malt varieties and hop varieties and yeast varieties and wild yeast that's just floating around us, that we can use to make these delicious beers, and kind of, you know, change perspectives on what beer really is. So, I think that's what's created a lot of the excitement around craft beer, too, is just the innovation and these different styles that make it so exciting.
Yeah, well, often we don't think of engineers as having an artistic bent or liking that necessarily. But in this case, the art of this whole thing with brewing is definitely there. And Lee, you were mentioning something about how does the art play with you for that?
Yeah, I never really thought of myself as being an artist. It was only when I got the invitation to do this that I started thinking, and I realized, yes, what I'm really doing is art. I'm a beer judge, a certified beer judge with the BJCP, and our score sheet that we work with starts with the aroma. So you open that bottle of beer, you take a look at it before you open it, but you evaluate the aroma, you evaluate the appearance, you evaluate the flavor, you evaluate the mouthfeel. So every aspect of the senses is incorporated. The sound is maybe the hardest one, but you know, when you take that cap off, you hear the CO2 in the bottle release there, and hear that as well. In fact, there's one of the big domestics is running this big campaign on television right now about the sound the beer makes when you open it. So really all the senses are covered.
Wow.
Let's back it up a little bit here for anybody at home who's listening that maybe enjoys beer but doesn't realize how it is made. I mean, you've kind of said that in a little bit very simple terms, but what is the process of making beer?
Yeah, well, it starts with water. Mm-hmm. Most of beer is water. But, you know, malt, hops, yeast, and water are the four main ingredients. There's plenty of other ingredients that are made. But a lot of it is like it's cooking. You take malted barley and you partially crush it, partially crack it, and you steep it in water at a certain temperature in order to extract sugar from that barley. That malted barley. Once you have that, you boil it, you add hops, and once you cool it back down is when you pitch yeast, and that's when you're actually making beer. Because what the yeast does is it breaks down those sugars into CO2 and alcohol. That's the process in a nutshell. After you start making alcohol, then you can filter out solids, and you can, you know, on a small scale, you just kind of let the beer age, you cool it down, let everything kind of settle out. After that is when you bottle it or keg it or however you want to serve it. But that's in a very short, there's a lot more steps in the process, but that's basically what we're doing. We're taking sugars, adding yeast to break it down to create the beer.
What's interesting is that 500 years ago, and even beyond, people were making beer and didn't even understand that yeast was part of the process. The original German brewing laws, Reinheitsgebot, was just it's like 502 years ago that it was first created, only had three ingredients. The yeast was not understood. They took the malt, they took the water, they took the hops, and they put it into an open fermenter, and it magically turned into beer. They had no idea that there was yeast falling into it.
And that the yeast was in the air or whatever.
Yeast was there. It wasn't until many hundreds of years, several hundred years later, that they finally updated the law and said that it's now four ingredients instead of three.
That's really interesting. And, you know, some things where you read about it, it may be, in fact, one of the oldest kind of fermented drink ever is beer. And, you know, there are other things there, but it makes sense because you were saying, Peter, the simple ingredients that you can readily have available. You didn't have to know about yeast. But the water was so bad in early times that, and even still in some countries around the world, people still drink an alcoholic drink over water. This is a way of turning your water, right, into something that's safer enough to drink through that fermentation.
Yeah, that was very much, very common. I mean, in Germany, everybody drank beer back in the, it was very low alcohol beer, but they would have the table beers that they would drink because it was safe water.
Wow. And more and more, the I know in Indiana, we're growing more hops and that types of things too, whereas in the past that we kind of had to go out of state to get those kind of things too. So that's like another industry that's kind of growing because of the growth and the surge of these craft brewers.
Yeah, most hops traditionally for us have been sourced from the Pacific Northwest, so Yakima, and along that same parallel, you know, a little bit north of us in Michigan is starting to grow a lot of hops. And here in Indiana, there's several growers that at Upland we've used. One of the most kind of interesting beers I think that we make is we use fresh hops. So normally, once hops are ready to be harvested, they're dried, pelletized, used for, you know, and made so that they can be stored and used commercially. But what we do, and there's a handful of brewers that do this, is you take them fresh right off of the vine and immediately add them to beer. So that's very difficult to do if you're sourcing it from the Pacific Northwest. So now that there's growers here in Indiana, we've been able to, over the last couple of years, you know, drive to the farm, get the hops and put them in the beer that same day. It's been a really remarkable experience for us. And so, yeah, there's hop growers. There's also maltster now in Indiana, up in Lebanon, Sugar Creek Malt, where he's doing some really creative stuff with smoked malts, roasting malts. So it's really pretty amazing, the agriculture that it's affected. In our sour beer program, we use lots of fruits from Indiana. So we use pawpaw fruits and persimmon fruits. We're getting strawberries from Indiana, black raspberries from Indiana. So it's a really wonderful part of our process, I think, using a lot of kind of natural ingredients from Indiana to make some really interesting beers.
Yeah, so when we were talking earlier, it's a whole lot of the engineering and taking the right steps to produce in the right order, understanding the quantities and the science of that. But then there's this other side, which you were just saying. So all of a sudden you're using a fruit or a flavor, and that is art because there's no preciseness to that because it's going to vary based on what fruit you have and the taste.
Yeah, I mean, any of your fruits and vegetables, the amount of flavor that you're going to get out of a given batch of that fruit can vary quite a bit. I do a saison that had jalapeno in it, and I was getting so much variation in it. I found that if I move over to a serrano pepper instead of a jalapeno, I get a more even or predictable amount of kick in that saison to work with. So it's experimentation in a lot of ways to try and see how much of a given a fruit or vegetable that you're adding in, and keep incrementally improving that.
Yeah, so it really is a culinary art. I mean, we think of a lot of times having people that are, you know, chefs and people that do that. But in a way, you're doing the same thing. You're trying to balance finding the right thing, like you just said, the difference between a jalapeno pepper and a serrano pepper. Mm-hmm. In terms of its flavor and its heat.
Yeah, absolutely. There's flavor, there's heat, there's color, there's acidity. So for the beers that we make that we use different types of fruits, we have to take into consideration how much acid is going to be contributed from that fruit, like a citric acid or malic acid, because what we don't want to do is add so much acidity that actually the acidity that's just coming naturally from the beer, we don't want to overpower it and make it too acidic, too sour. So there's absolutely an art to all of this, and a lot of it comes down to the palate of the brewer, the training, and, you know, the practice. You know, that's a lot of it too, is, you know, being able to, as a judge or as, you know, anyone that's brewing beer, and will tell you, you know, sensory is the single biggest skill that you need to build first. I mean, being able to detect, is my beer tasting right? Is it clean? Is some other weird bug that's growing in there that's not supposed to be in there? So the sensory aspect is so, so important. But then the appearance, you know, there's, I think that's where a lot of romance comes into play too, because, you know, what brewers hate seeing is the wrong beer poured into the wrong type of glassware with no foam. And it makes a huge difference in the experience if you've got the right kind of beer in the right proper glass with the right amount of foam. And that, in you know, a friend of mine was telling me, we used to have a beer that was just in a straight shaker pint, and we made the decision to put it in a nice tall Pilsner glass with a foot on it, and a proper pour of that glass in the sunshine on a patio, the experience is just completely different. And so I think of that a lot, of the art of what we do too, is, you know, the right style of beer, it's presented in the right way, and you know, that's what gets me really excited about what we do, and that this, it is an you're experiencing lots of different steps with a lot of science and engineering behind it. The end result is this really great experience.
And there's a huge difference then too between a lager and an ale and a saison, and those are kind of things, I guess, as you get more into the beer, you explore those different areas.
You've got lots of different styles mm-hmm. out there. I mean, the style guide, which was most recently updated in 2015, has about 25 or so major categories, which each have a number of subcategories to them. So there's all the different styles that talk explicitly about what the aroma should be like, what the flavor should be like, what the balance between the hops and the malts should be like, the mouthfeel, whether or not it should be have a big body, a little, you know, smaller body type of a beer. And every one of those styles has places where it's more appropriate than others. I mean, dark beers in the wintertime are more prominent because it's more of a big beer that you may be sitting in front mm-hmm. of a fireplace sipping that beer in that environment, versus the beer that you grab when you come in from mowing the grass, which are sometimes, those kinds of beers are sometimes referred to as lawnmower beers, where they're a much lighter, crisper, cleaner beer that refreshes you after having come inside. So, yeah, where that beer is appropriate, how that beer appears when it's served, all comes into play.
So that's really interesting, because we would not think of drinking straight out of a bottle of wine, because it wasn't part of the whole experience. I mean, there probably are people that do, but it isn't. But it is interesting to move from, you know, sitting at a sporting event drinking out of a can mm-hmm. or a bottle, even at something, and to where it is. To me, I wonder if that isn't part of why the brewery movement is succeeding. It's not only it is the thing that you're making in the beer, but also the way in which it's presented and the context in which it's doing. So, Peter, I know you've got several breweries opening, but how does that play? Does it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's I get this question a lot. You know, what's your favorite beer? You know, what do you like to have? And the answer I always give is I don't have a single favorite beer. It depends on the time and the place and all those things. Like in the fall, an Oktoberfest out of a big stein with all my friends at a party, like that's pretty amazing experience. But there's times when we've done, you know, a five course beer and food pairing where we have barrel-aged sours that have been in the barrel for 3 years and two different kinds of fruits and paired with these delicious meals. It's just a, like a fine dining experience. So that I think we try to not take ourselves too seriously. And it's like, hey, you know, we have a good time with beer. You know, beer is at a ball game, and we're not going to, you know, hit on people that want to drink out of a can of ball game. That's what it's there for.
Right.
But we also respect and appreciate when you're able to display it in different ways, and people can experience that. And we love introducing people to a different way to experience beer, because like wine, you don't always think about food and beer pairing with beer. And I would argue that there's lots of ways you can make those pairings, even more so than wine, because there's just such a wide spectrum of flavors from beer.
And another thing I think with people, and that points to it once again, it's the same thing with wine. People say, oh, I don't like wine. Well, have you tried every type of wine? The same thing with beer. I don't really like beer, because there are so many different styles. And a lot of people are like, oh, it's just too bitter for me. But that's the hops factor. And so it fluctuates depending on different styles.
Yeah, there's certain beers that are very hoppy. Mm-hmm. And for people who don't like hops, it's probably not the beer for them. But there is a whole spectrum of beers where the hop is very subtle and it's providing a balance to the beer, but you don't really even pick it up as a separate aspect of the beer that you're drinking. I mean, last night... my homebrew club was serving beer at the History on Tap up at Connor Prairie, a really nice brew fest that they hold up there. And a number of people would come up and say, I want the IPA. I want your wheat beer, because those are the beers that they think of when they think craft beer, and that's what they've gotten used to. Others, craft beer, that's a whole spectrum. So I had a one of my beers I had up there was an Oud Bruin. They had a Scottish export. We had a dark mild, had a Vienna lager on tap. So a wide spectrum of beers on tap. And you can see some people, it's very much, they think one style. Other people, they think the broad range of styles that are available.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about the history and the style, too. We're going to take a short little break, and then we're going to come back with Lee and Peter and with your questions, too. We're talking about the art and engineering of beer. The number's 317-788-3314, and we'll be back right after this with more of She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Hello again. I'm Joe Girard, your host for Inside Great American Music. And as you know by now, we're here every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on 88.7, the Diamond WICR. Our show revolves around the great American songbook, and this week a special treat, we're featuring the great Mr. Jack Jones. So join us this week, 5 p.m. Sunday, right here on 88.7, the Diamond, WICR.
Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Jill Dittmeyer, journalist and arts and culture enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. And we are the hosts of a new program on WICR called
She Says Art
and He Says Science.
Each week we use art to teach science and bring you an hour of edutainment as we learn about the creative interaction between artist and scientist. Join us Saturday afternoons at 1 for She Says Art
and He Says Science.
This is Rockin' Dave, inviting you to join me every Sunday at midnight for Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, an hour of the best rockabilly, jump blues, and western swing. That's Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, every Sunday at midnight on WICR The Diamond. Get your roots on!
And welcome back to She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And today we are talking with Peter and Lee about the art and engineering of beer. And during our little break, for science here, of course, Lee opened one of his homebrewed beers, and the label says Serrano Saison, so Saison like a season, like a seasonal beer. You have Let's see. It says life begins at 60, 1.60 SG. What does that mean on the label, Lee?
Well, a common slogan that brewers will use is life begins at 60, 1060. 1060 is a gravity measurement that's sort of an average beer gravity. So gravity is how much sugar were we able to get into the water. We start with water, we start with malts. The purpose of the malts is to turn the carbohydrates in the grains into sugar. That sugar ends up in the liquid, which is now called wort, which is what we will then boil to and add the hops to prepare it for fermentation.
So the sugar is what the yeast loves, right?
Yes.
It feeds the yeast.
Yes. So the beginning gravity of the wort that you're going to ferment, 1060 is kind of an average beer. It'll produce a 5 or 6% beer from that kind of a gravity. Higher gravity means that you're going to get a bigger beer. It might be a stout. Smaller gravity could be a smaller beer. It might be a low-gravity pilsner, or it could be a lighter beer would be a lower number than 1060. But 1060 kind of being in that middle range there.
Wow.
So on my particular bottle here, I sort of took that slogan and said, okay, life begins at 60, 1160, because 1160 is 100 points higher than 1060. So a really big beer. It's the gravity that I got on a barley wine. That's 16%, which I do have a bottle of here if everybody's good.
Nobody will be driving after that one.
Yeah.
So 16% is the alcohol level.
Yes,
so,
yes.
And in this beer, we have, it looks like, 6% ABV?
This one here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we've got some other information on the label here. And I know this is a homebrew beer versus Peter with Upland. What information do you have to put on the label for the consumer to know about, and what should we look for on the label when we're looking at beers?
Yeah, we typically will make sure we have the alcohol content on there, and we'll also include the IBUs typically, which it's a unit to measure bitterness.
Okay.
So
is it the higher or lower for the more bitter?
More bitter is a higher number.
Okay.
And we also will make sure we put the style. So sometimes we have some hybrid styles, so we'll try to describe it the best we can. But typically, it's what Lee was talking about, the accepted styles, IPA, Pilsner, Pale Ale, Porter. We'll make sure that that's on there as well. And that's really those are the main things. There's other government regulated statements we have to have on there. But for us, we also include the independent brewer seal on our labels. That's something you may start to see a lot more of from craft brewers. And that just means, we're an independently owned company and are part of a small craft community.
And have it sold out to one of the big guys.
Right.
go ahead.
One of the things that I understand is that for home brewing, though, that's sort of been only in the United States recently okay. That it was actually Jimmy Carter who signed into law the ability to do it legally.
Yeah, at the federal level, that was done in the 1978, right. I want to say, that Jimmy Carter signed the law that made homebrewing legal in the United States. Now, that didn't mean that the states didn't have their
right.
say on what you could do right. with your beer and things of that nature. I mean, the fact that we can now in Indiana, as a homebrewer, take our beer to a public festival such as History on Tap and serve our beer, we've come a long way.
Yeah.
We're not just stuck in our basements brewing beer and drinking the beer in our basement. We're actually able to take it. We can't sell it because excise wouldn't
let you sell it.
Would not let us do that. But we are able to take that beer to particular events that want to show off homebrewers and serve our beer, which is great. I mean, you get the feedback of the public.
Wow.
And we also talked about the different styles of beer, too. And on your label, you have listed here style, spice, herb, and vegetable, Belgian Saison.
Okay. So because this is based on a very specific style called Saison, which is a Belgian, one of the Belgian styles of beer, The fact that it has the serrano pepper in it now moves it from a judging point of view into spice, herb, and vegetable, which is where any beer that you have added spice, herbs, or vegetables to get judged. In judging, you are required to say what the base beer is and what the additions are. And as a judge, what we're looking for is that the base style is still very much there and recognizable, and that what you've done to that beer with the spice, herb, and vegetable is complementing it, not overshadowing it or detracting from it. So
we also see, so it's ABV, the 6%. So is that just kind of a regular neutral alcohol percent in a beer, or is that high or low? How does that?
It's kind of in the middle. You'll find very small beers, 3.5-4%. The dark mouths we were serving up at Connor Prairie last night are in the 3.5-4% range. It is a dark beer, so it's a little misleading in that you normally think dark beer means bigger beer, but there's an English style that is actually a small beer that is dark. So it's sort of in the middle. You get stouts and barley wines. You're talking 10, 12, maybe up to 16%.
Oh, it's like a wine. And IBU, so this is the bitterness scale, 67.94.
Okay. The bitterness units are measured from 0 to 100. Okay. You'll see people who actually exceed, in some of the IPAs, they'll use numbers that are even higher than that. But from a judging point of view, technically, that's how they're measured. So it's just a level of hop. Now, in this particular Saison, the kick from the Serrano sort of supplants
that
some of that
fruitiness of that kind of balance,
and gives you a little bit of that kick in the place of some of the bitterness that you might otherwise expect.
The reason I'm asking about all of this is because I deal with wine a lot, so I have a lot of people asking me, when I look at the label, is there any way I can know what I might be getting from the inside? And the same thing kind of plays out with beer too, I think, because once again we talked about some people like, oh, they're too bitter for me, or they're too alcoholic for me, that kind of thing.
That really helps me, what Jill was just saying, Peter, to figure out, when I go, I don't like it really hoppy.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff happening right now with beer labeling and what the appearance of the beer looks like. So some of the beers that we do, if we want to really have a strong expression of fruit, and that's the primary ingredient, we name it that fruit. So one of our beers is called raspberry, so you can guess that's going to taste. Or cherry, peach, pawpaw. So these fruited sour beers. It's very clear, and when we do that, our intention there is that it's a very prominent flavor we want you to taste a pawpaw when you drink this beer. Another phenomenon that's been going on for a couple of years now that I'm a big fan of, and it's been really growing around breweries, is this style called the New England style IPA. And the New England style has, I think, been received quite well because the bitterness of this IPA, which are typically thought of as very bitter and harsh on the palate, these actually don't have a lot of bitterness, but you still taste this hop character, this fruitiness, all these amazing hop flavors without this kind of aftertaste of bitterness. And so I encourage folks to think about that, because oftentimes just because it's an IPA doesn't mean it's going to be harshly bitter. And actually the palates over the last several years, 5-10 years ago, craft beer was very bitter. The more bitter, the better. Higher alcohol, the better. That's changed a lot. And, a lot of the new recipes we're developing, we're trying to minimize bitterness but still have all this hop flavor. So there's a lot of approachable beers now because there's super tasters out there that bitterness really affects them quite a bit. So
if that goes down the path of, hops serve three purposes in a beer. They are there for bitterness, they're there for flavor, and they're there for the aroma. And depending on when in the boil you put those hops into the boil will determine how that particular hop, the hop characteristics of the particular hops you're using will also, some hops are just more naturally going to give you more bitterness units. But early hops in a boil are going to give bitterness. Then you're going to get flavor out of later hops, and the ones you do right at the end are going to be aroma. In a New England IPA, or what's now a milkshake IPAs as well, almost no bitterness hops are going into most of those recipes. The hops are all being done at a later point, which means it's turning them into aroma and flavor as opposed to bitterness. So the confusion can be there in that somebody refers to it as being a hoppy beer. So it's not a bitter beer. It's a hoppy beer. Hoppiness really refers more to the flavor and aroma aspects of what the hop's doing in that beer as opposed to the bitterness aspects that it could be doing.
Wow, that's really fascinating. And the other that a lot of people don't think about with a beer, except I did remember as a kid when you were around in my generation, I'm almost 65, and we had around us a lot of times we'd go to an event where a lot of people had been drinking, and that was the smell we got used to. But like the one you have in the studio is just incredibly wonderful smell. It has a fragrant smell. It doesn't smell like beer. and I think that people miss smelling a beer. You know, we get used to, mm-hmm. Jill, you're used to people smelling a wine. But beers now can have, the smell is just as important, isn't it, Peter?
Yeah, and you know, I'm not a great beer historian, so bear with me here. But, you know, initially, very, very early on in beer, spices and herbs and all these other fruits were added. And it wasn't until these large mass production of beers is where a lot of those things started to go out of favor. And it's, you know, it's bitterness and very light, easy drinking, I don't like to say flavorless, but very muted flavors. But if you look at these, a lot of these historical styles are all coming back to life now. You know, what we do with our sour beers, Belgian lambic style, that's been around forever. And those beers all have spices and fruits and all these amazing flavors added. And that's, I think, what's contributed to such a growth in craft brewers is finding these old styles that have all this flavor and then putting a different spin on it. You know, something that, and sometimes like what Lee's done, you know, you take a Saison-based style and you just put your own different spin. You know, the peppers, or you may add molasses, or you may add some other spices to give it even more pronounced flavor to complement some of that base style. And then in addition to all of those spices and fruits, yeasts have become more available, so different yeasts impart different flavors. It may taste spicy and floral and all these things, and there's no spice in it. It just came from the yeast. So it's really amazing. And the engineering side of that, it sometimes can be difficult on a very small scale, but with the yeast in particular, we have these large tanks, and we have to have pretty precise ways of controlling temperature. So for a Belgian wit beer or even like German Hefeweizen, those yeast strains at different temperatures, different flavors are expressed. So if you want something with a little bit more banana than clove, you adjust the temperature. And on a, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 gallon batch, you need to have pretty tight temperature control. And that's another way that brewers can innovate and be creative is, well, I want my Hefeweizen to have these different flavors, or I want to express these in a different way. So that's for me, you know, trying to tie the art and science, the art and engineering on a large scale, having process control so that you can still really dial in these precise flavors with pretty large equipment.
Yeah. You mentioned history of beer, and Indiana has a huge history in beer, and many people are aware, maybe not, of Rita Kahn, who is an amazing historian. She used to write the Beer Buzz for Nouveau. She has written numerous books on beer. She's authoring a book right now about the history of beer in Indiana and the ties that it's had to the growth of business, of everything from our roads to the way our cities are planned and have expanded across the state. And it also makes me wonder then if there is kind of this look back then to see what beers were popular in this part of Indiana at a certain time of history that we could recreate again too.
Yeah, we have a pretty nice story on that. Several years back, we looked into that very thing. And there's a heritage beer called Champagne Velvet, mm-hmm. that was made at the Terre Haute Brewing Company, pre-Prohibition Pilsner. And the original brewer with German roots, he came here from Germany and was trying to emulate some of those German beers and wanted to use the resources around him. And so there's corn in there from Indiana. And nowadays you hear corn, you hear all this stuff on TV with corn syrup and all that. That's you know, at some point it became an adjunct to help reduce costs and all that. But in fact, when this recipe was originally designed it, it was more expensive to use corn. So it was there for flavor. And so that was our inspiration when we got the rights to brew this beer. And so we brewed the beer for our 15th anniversary to celebrate Indiana beer, Indiana heritage. At one point, it was a massive beer, not just in Indiana, it sold nationally. Mm-hmm. I think it was, this number changes all the time. It was like anywhere from 300 to 400,000 barrels of beer. It's bigger than any brewery in Indiana right now. There's a lot of history there, especially in Terre Haute. There's the Terre Haute Brewing Company still there, and it's been a great story for us, and the beer is doing very well. We did it for our 15th anniversary. And it's just kind of caught on, and we're seeing a lot of success with that. The label and the branding is all, you know, kind of retro from back in the day. So
somebody wrote a song for you too. I know you had a song written about Champagne Velvet because there was an original jingle, I believe, when they sold it. It came back around too.
It's got all kinds of fun.
I would think that history would be a big thing for home brewers too.
Yes, I mean, we certainly this area here having German roots. Mm-hmm. The beers back in the the past were German, the Cincinnati area up through this area here. And those beers were brewed based on what the settlers had done back in Germany at the time. And it was sort of some of those beers that were taken and then picked up by some of what are now the big domestics as a starting point. And then in trying to drive the cost down, get production up, they were no longer necessarily that closely recognizable as being what they had been. We've got a number of breweries around here in central Indiana who are very much into the European, German styles. We've got a new brewery going to be opening up in Noblesville by two members of the Foam Blowers Homebrew Club. We'll be opening up in probably the August timeframe. Their whole thing is European style, so you'll have English dark mild, you'll have Hefeweizen, you'll have English porter. Some of the styles you don't necessarily find in that many places, but there's several breweries around here in central Indiana who are brewing those roots, and a lot of those came from homebrewers.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, you were mentioning Peter and Lee the same way, that they came from Germany, but they had to use local ingredients, which sometimes would alter the formula a little bit to change it from where it was originally. So the addition of corn. Mm-hmm. And then I think about the science in there when we were talking about a carbohydrate that can be converted to sugar for the fermentation with corn. Obviously, that's where we get the negative things today. It's a carbohydrate that changes very quickly into a sugar. Mm-hmm. And gets used, but
a very simple sugar.
Yeah,
you
very
get simple sugars, and you get more
mm-hmm.
complex sugars.
Yeah, so the chemistry here is very interesting.
It's just there to get the gravity up, so that you get the alcohol content.
Get the alcohol content to flow with it,
and the history and the community of it too, of the building. Why there are so many breweries is because if you had a community of people that came from one place and they all liked that same kind of flavor, they could start their own little brewery and survive just mm-hmm. alone with the local people around there, as opposed to say like a winery or something where you're dealing with more product, more people on a wider scale and a longer time frame too. I think the other thing, that the other big difference between wine and beers too. And I think maybe that's another reason we've seen this explosion of craft beer. Almost every quarter, there's a different one. But everybody's doing something different.
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. a new brewery opening almost every month in central Indiana here. I think it's doubled in the last 4 years, the number. Almost anywhere you are, you can walk to a brewery. I mean, I parked my car out here in the parking lot, and there's books and brews right across the street there. So
U of I.
Yeah, and the timing, as you mentioned, to make beer, typically it is 2 to 4 weeks. But there are some styles that can take 2 to 3 years. And so it just really depends on what you want to do with the beer and the style that you're making. So, for example, just a standard ale, like an IPA, could take you 2 weeks. And you want to use a very specific type of yeast and very specific sugars that you want to put into that. When we make sour beer, barrel-aged sour beer, Belgian-style lambic, those we actually do different things in the brew house. We extract different types of sugars from the malt and grain. We want very complex sugars that regular brewer's yeast cannot break down. So we mash at different temperatures. We may boil the mash, create dextrins and all these really complex sugars that wild yeast and bacteria can break down. However, it takes a lot longer. And so most of our barrels are in wood, and those wood vessels contain these wild yeast and bacteria, and we let it age for, it can start to really taste good at 6 months, but then it could take up to 3 years of this very slow fermentation. And so that's, you know, there's different, and to make those beers, it takes a heck of a lot more time and cost and all those things, but the results are just really amazing. You can make a tart beer. We like don't call them sour beers, but kettle souring. You can make a tart beer in a couple of weeks. Very, very different process. And in that case, you're using one specific lactobacillus bacteria to sour, and you boil it, and then you treat it like any other beer. And those are getting really popular and have a very different flavor profile than what most people are used to. So we have a couple beers where we've made that style and added passion fruit and mango, or we've added rose petals and hibiscus and strawberries. And they're these really beautiful, refreshing, summery tart beers that have been really doing very well. But I would encourage, you know, anyone that, you know, there's so many similarities to wine with barrel aging and the time, but that you're absolutely right, you know, to open up and start brewing and having something ready to drink in 2 to 3 weeks is pretty amazing.
Whereas a winery has to wait at least a year or so, longer a lot of times. They'll have other people make for it. But we're talking about beer this afternoon. If you have a question for us, we'd love for you to give us a call, 317-788-3314. We're going to take another quick break, and then we will be back with more of She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Mozart preferred subtlety to flashy showmanship, but sometimes he just couldn't help himself. In 1779, he added a little feature to make the viola stand out. The solo part in the music you'll hear Monday is written in a lower key, so the performer has to tune it up, making the viola sound a bit more brilliant in the process. I'm Michael Toulouse. Join me for the Sinfonia Concertante in E-flat.
Listen Monday morning from 6 to 10 only on 88.7 WICR. The Score is a weekly celebration of the music that makes good movies great. Host Edmund Stone covers all the bases with such topics as playing politics, summer blockbusters, The Orchestrator, Stranded, and features on individual composers for the cinema. It's a cultural trip through everyone's most common musical experience. That's The Score with Edmund Stone, Saturday mornings at 10 on WICR, a different kind of public radio.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
When you listen to Folk Alley, you experience a tradition that's been handed down for hundreds of years. I'm Elena C., and Folk Alley is a link in the chain that includes the ancient child ballads and the latest releases from your favorite singer-songwriters. Bluegrass, Celtic, Americana blues, and much more. It's all part of the Folk Alley mix. So I hope you'll join me each week on Folk Alley.
Join us for Folk Alley, Sundays at 9 p.m.
And welcome back to She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And we are talking beer this afternoon. Joining us in studio are Peter and Lee. And as we mentioned before, Lee brought one of his homebrew beers, and he's poured it, and we've been smelling it and sipping it and talking about it. And you poured it in a specific glass, which kind of reckons back to, Peter, something that you brought up a little earlier in our conversation as well, that a lot of times people just think, oh, it's a beer, we'll just drink it out of the bottle. But the glass can make a big difference.
Yes, this isn't necessarily the glass you would pour a Saison into to drink it. It just happened I had a few of these.
These are almost like little tiny goblet-style glasses.
So they're nice. They focus the aroma because of the way the lip comes up and around. Lets you pick up on the aroma a little more than a wide-open glass. It might let the aroma escape more. I mean, in beer judging, the reason we evaluate aroma first is because it's the most fleeting part of that piece of art that is in front of you. You open it up. We carbonate beers with CO2. That CO2 serves several different purposes, one of which is to, when you open the bottle, release, which is why you get the foam on the surface of the beer. But it's also, while it's releasing there, it is bringing the aromas and focusing them right at the nose of the glass so that you can pick up the best aroma. If you want to get the aroma back again, swirl the glass a little bit, you'll release a little more of the CO2 and pick up some more of the aroma. So we evaluate that first, and then we go for flavor because the flavor will be generally more lasting, won't fleet away as quickly as the as aroma. Another purpose of CO2 is mouthfeel. It's part of what makes the beer, and it depends on the style again. Highly carbonated beer is one where you want it to be light and refreshing and crisp on your tongue. And CO2, having it more highly carbonated, makes it so that it will do that and give you some of that crispness on the tongue. And serving it cold will, in addition, a little colder. Whereas a stout, you're not looking necessarily for as much of that crispness. I mean, it's a bigger, bolder beer to start with. Oftentimes, you'll get more of the flavor out of a stout if you let it warm up some. You don't really want to drink that one at 40 degrees because you're going to miss a lot of the flavor. I see places, restaurants, bragging about the fact that their beer is at 29 degrees. Well, if you don't want to taste it, that's a good thing to do, because what the coldness does is it numbs your taste buds to where you don't really taste all the aspects of the beer, and you really want to drink a beer that's not in a frozen, frosted mug. Drink it out of something where you can actually taste the flavor.
Jill, we're looking at the bottle, and we've kind of read through the label. But I know that this is really just as important from the art side, Peter, is the design of labels and the graphics. That this is becoming a huge deal, I know, even in the wine industry, but particularly in the beer industry. Can you talk a little bit about that art form?
Yeah. So the branding and how the customer, how people kind of perceive the beer, it all starts with the label and the shelf and on the label. So for what we do, oftentimes we'll have that in mind when we are making the designs and what we want to articulate about that beer. So our sour beers, the label and the branding are very different than our beers that we make in our big production brewery. We've partnered with an artist, Michael Chena, and have about 7 or 8 of his original pieces of blended inks or blended pieces of art. And you know, our tagline for the for those beers, they are blended works of art. To make sour beer, it's a lot of blending of different barrels and different batches to achieve this really complex layered acidity. And so the label, when you see that bottle, it's not just the label, it's also the bottle style. We use a larger format with a cork and a cage. That kind of indicates for that it's actual bottle conditioned, a different type of carbonation. We can talk about that if you'd like, but it gives a different visual experience with that beer, and we try to make sure that the outward appearance of the beer matches the quality of the liquid inside. There's lots of different approaches for beer labels. That's just one for us. Some are a lot more playful. You know, Champagne Velvet, it's got a very classic, iconic, old school branding. But our Dragonfly is hand-drawn by local artists, things like that. So it's a really fun part of craft beer. There's, you know, I've heard of tattoo artists getting into beer labels, and there's some really amazing art that's showing up on craft beer labels here in Indiana. I mean, it's a really fun part of what we do.
Lee, any judging that's gone on? That I know you generally judge just what's inside the bottle. But has there been any movement to judge from the outgo, from looking at the label all the way through?
Well, there's a small problem with that. That is that when you're judging beer, you have no idea whose beer.
Ah.
You only know the style,
right.
Where it was put into the competition. And we've got the big Indiana Brewers Cup coming up here, and we'll be judging that in July. And that one has about 1,500 beers in it. 800 of them are homebrew, and the other 700 are pro brew. they're judged in two separate, the homebrewers are not going up against the pro brew, two separate segments of the competition. But it's the same people doing the judging.
It's blind judging.
You have no idea. And in the case of homebrew, right. A bottle with no labeling is what you have to submit. Pro brewers have a little more problem with that because they're packaging with all that nice graphic right. on there. So the stewards in the back are taking their beer, pouring it into a pitcher, bringing a pitcher out to the table for the actual judging.
Wow.
I do know that in wine competitions, and I'm sure it's happening, there are label competitions, but they're judged by separate people, not the wine judges.
Right.
Yeah,
interesting.
You don't want to see that. Let's talk about the glasses again then, too, Peter, because that is really interesting. It's another easy way to enhance your experience of beer for someone. What would be a couple of suggestions you would have for somebody at home to try?
Yeah, so depending on the when we're serving at our retail outlets or our restaurants or our brew pubs, we factor in alcohol content too. Mm-hmm. So a smaller portion size for very high alcohol. If it's a more sessionable, a lower alcohol beer, a little bit bigger format. But for our sour beers, we actually tend to serve those in what's called a teku style glass. But it's almost like a wine glass. It's got a long stem. Lee was saying, the top of the glass actually forces aroma to kind of come out towards the nose, and it's almost more like a wine glass than it is more of a wine glass than a beer glass. But there are some that they're designing now specifically for these styles of beers. So that would be one recommendation on sours is not like your typical shaker pint glass. I would not pour a sour beer into that.
And that's so you can have more of the aromatic experience for a longer period of time.
There's
and
that,
then is the mouthfeel as well.
There's the aromatic piece of it. It's the presentation of the beer as well. It looks very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Different color too.
Different
I'm
color.
Sure.
There, mm-hmm. You know, we have red, pink hues in the different colors of the beer. And the portion size too. So sour beers are also, the barrel aged sours are not based on the acidity and sometimes higher alcohol level. You know, we don't expect, it's not to be drank in large volumes. So, you know, it's more of a sipping, smaller portion size type of a beer versus a Pilsner or a Kölsch or something that's a lighter style, you know, a little bit larger format. We like serving in the Belgian tulip glass, kind of a bell at the bottom, kind of curves up to the top. Very beautiful way to present beer, giving yourselves plenty of room to have foam on top. Like Lee was saying, I can't reiterate that enough. That's why we like pouring it out of the bottle, out of the can. It opens the beer up, releases that CO2. Those are a couple different options. Of course, if you're drinking a fest beer, Oktoberfest, I got to say the Leader Steins are always very,
Steins,
very fun.
Yes. With your Lederhosen.
Yeah,
they're easier to clunk while you're drinking.
Absolutely.
But one of the worst things, sometimes a new brewery will open up and try to save money. And you go in and they serve it in a plastic cup.
Ooh.
And that's just, you know, so they missed the point there.
I mean, that's like wine in there. Yes. Yeah. But you've given me, both of you have given Jill and I this new appreciation for thinking about beer and the way you serve it and what it would go with. And, this has just opened some new avenues for me thinking.
We're getting close on time here, but I want each of you to give me two beers that people at home that are interested in beer should try this summer.
If you're getting started with beer and haven't really done much, a wheat beer. Hefeweizen, I think, is a wonderful beer, or a Belgian wit. Either of those are wonderful beers to start with. And the summer, Saison.
Saison is a good thing. Peter?
Yeah, I started mentioning this a little bit earlier about these tart beers. I think it's a totally different experience with beer. Ours is Two of Tarts with passion fruit mango. There's also plenty of other examples. You may have heard of like Dogfish Sea Quench is another example. It's a style that I think is growing, and it changes your mindset on beer a little bit. The other one would be, you know, this New England style IPA. I think that's just growing in popularity.
It's something new to find, I think.
Yeah.
Great suggestions. Peter, Lee, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Check out our website, right, Mark?
Right. You'll find pictures and projects about other guests. But
TheDaVinciPursuit.com. Till next time, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.
Here at WICR, we love connecting with our listeners over the airwaves. And you can connect with us even more by liking us on Facebook and following us on Twitter at WICR Online, where you can find exclusive station content. Don't forget to also log on to our homepage on WICRonline.org.
Even ancient music from centuries ago can sound fresh and alive, even contemporary. Every week on Sunday Baroque, you can hear a variety of modern performers treat the music as a living art form and put their unique imaginative stamp on music from the 18th century and earlier. I'm Suzanne Bona, and I hope you can join me for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.